remind you before we start to please switch off all mobile phones or put them to silent mode. Thank you very much. Before we turn to our topic today, which is of course Malaysia, I'd like to tell you about a talk that we're going to have tomorrow. Paul Midler will be here to talk about his book, Poorly Made in China. Quite a good sign up for that, so if you're interested, please mention it to one of the staff on the way out and we'll get you a seat for that tomorrow. Okay, well, turning to today's topic, as I said, which is about Malaysia and specifically about the former Prime Minister of Malaysia, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad. I think, you know, love him or hate him, you can't deny that Dr. Mahathir has managed to transform Malaysia into one of the developing world's most successful economies. And the impact that he has had on Malaysia is actually still being felt even today. And to discuss this topic, we have journalist and author Barry Wayne, who joins us today to talk a little bit about his new book, which he will be signing after the talk today, and it's available over here. The book is called Malaysian Maverick, Mahathir Mohamad, excuse me, Mahathir Mohamad in Turbulent Times. And Mr. Wayne is the former editor of the Wall Street Journal, Asia. He is currently writer in residence at the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies in Singapore. He's originally from Australia, but has been living and working in the region for more than three decades, close to four decades. And he will be a familiar face to many of you here today. So can you please join me in giving him a very warm welcome to talk about Dr. Mahathir and his impact on Malaysia in the past and going forward. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Colm, and thanks very much to the FCC for inviting me to speak today. I'm delighted, of course, to be back in Hong Kong, where I spent something like 23 years of my life, and where I know issues of censorship occasionally arise. I know a little bit about that where my book is concerned. The Malaysian government has yet to decide whether they're going to let it circulate in Malaysia. It's been through a review period of 60 days, and now we're waiting for a decision by the minister. On New Year's Eve, the Malaysian High Court ruled that Roman Catholics could use Allah to mean God in their local Malay language newspaper. The ruling was widely seen as a victory for Malaysia's ethnic Chinese, Indian, and indigenous minorities. Although the court within days suspended its judgment to allow a government appeal against the ruling to be heard, large numbers of Malaysian Muslims, mostly Malays, signed protest petitions and made preparations to hold rallies. The Malaysian government rarely tolerates political demonstrations, but it tacitly approved the protests set to coincide with Friday prayers on January the 8th. Despite rising tension, Prime Minister Najib Razak said Muslim groups were free to express their views on the Allah issue, as long as the rallies stayed within bounds. Beginning late that evening, across the next week, arsonists attacked at least nine churches in various states. The firebombing and vandalism of places of worship have profoundly shaken Malaysia's perception of itself and the image it has hitherto enjoyed internationally as a tolerant, peaceful, multi-ethnic and multi-religious country. Predictably, the government contended that these unprecedented attacks were isolated, the work of only a few individuals and not organized by any group. Without necessarily disputing that, I would argue that they are nevertheless not only symptomatic of the nature of religious politics in Malaysia today, but also a reflection of a crisis in the Malaysian body politic. The ruling United Malays National Organization, known as UMNO, in power for more than half a century, is morally exhausted and ideologically hollow. As it comes under pressure from resurgent opposition, UMNO directs its efforts not at finding solutions to various problems, but at staying in power. Faced with the real prospect of losing office, it has played a dangerous game with race and religion and has descended into extremism. Consider these three facts. One, the Arabic word Allah has been used by Christians in Malaysia and Indonesia, not to mention the Middle East, for decades, if not centuries. Indeed, Arabic-speaking Christians in the Arabian Peninsula were using Allah for God for 300 years before the rise of Islam. It became an issue in Malaysia only in 2007 when the government banned the use of Allah in the weekly Catholic newspaper, The Herald, which prints just 14,000 copies in four languages. Yet with the government fanning the flames, many Malay Muslims now find the court's decision an affront to Malay dignity and Muslim sensitivities. Two, Party Islam see Malaysia, the opposition Islamic party, usually considered prone to radicalism, accepted the High Court's ruling, while UMNO did not, confirming a trend that has been long in the making. As Tunku Razali Hamza, an UMNO veteran and former finance minister, put it, Party Islam is holding on to the more plural and moderate position, while UMNO is digging itself into an intolerant, hardline position that has no parallel I know of in the Muslim world. Three, in the wake of the church attacks, when minorities were looking to their government for support, comfort and reassurance, Islamic Affairs Minister Jamil Keir Bahrom called on Christian leaders to drop their claim to the use of Allah for the sake of peace and stability in Malaysia. In other words, the government, having stirred discontent and hostility on the issue for the past 3 years, now asks the victims to make concessions in the name of responsibility. Malaysia is beset with structural problems, mostly stemming from UMNO's domination of the country with essentially the same coalition partners since independence in 1957. Once an idealistic party, UMNO is now little more than a vehicle to dispense patronage to well-connected Malaysians. After working on the book, and here's the plug for my book, I can say that Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, who ruled in authoritarian fashion for 22 years before retiring in 2003, is largely responsible for the dismal state of Malaysian politics. While Dr. Mahathir did not invent the ills that afflict Malaysia, many of them spread widely and became entrenched on his long watch. To meet his obsession with turning Malaysia into a modern, fully developed and respected nation, Dr. Mahathir built impressive physical infrastructure and pursued breakneck growth. He engineered a socio-economic transformation, lessening Malaysia's dependence on commodities and deepening its industrialization. Under his constant prodding, Malaysia became one of the developing world's most successful economies, a favorite destination of foreign investment, an export dynamo. A striking reduction in poverty and increasing affluence gave Malaysia the look and feel of a sophisticated, prosperous country, with a greatly expanded middle class that included significant numbers of Malays. But Dr. Mahathir emphasized hardware at the expense of software. Unwilling to tolerate dissent, he eliminated rivals in UMNO as surely as he repressed the political opposition and pressured civil society critics. Viewing some state institutions as rival centers of power, he emasculated them so he would meet no obstruction. In head-on confrontations, he subdued both the judiciary and the monarchy, damaging Malaysia's separation of powers doctrine. Dr. Mahathir combined a vigorous privatization program with an affirmative action policy which channels extensive economic benefits to Bumiputras, predominantly Malays. He intervened personally to select Malay business executives to become role models for their community, handing them large chunks of the privatized economy to get started. He also took UMNO into business in a massive way, so that often it was party stalwarts rather than the poor who benefited most from affirmative action. Corruption and cronyism were hallmarks of the Mahathir era. With UMNO membership an avenue to riches, ever large amounts of money were poured into party and general elections to secure positions with access to tenders, licenses and subsidies, while party leaders in turn channeled benefits back to their supporters to maintain their posts. Locally, it's known as money politics, an entrenched system of payments that puts a price on nearly every post in UMNO in expectation of returns on investment. While Dr. Mahathir more than once shed tears in public about vote buying in UMNO elections, he failed to stop it. His presidency saw the final culmination of a transition from an UMNO of humble, self-sacrificing peasants and school teachers to a party of self-serving corporate chieftains and deal makers. Although he had more than two decades on top, Dr. Mahathir failed to provide for the leadership, the future leadership of Malaysia. He sidelined the three men, Tunku Razali Hamza, a former finance minister, Musa Hitam, a former deputy prime minister, and Anwar Ibrahim, another deputy prime minister, who would have made capable leaders. And his long tenure, of course, blocked the ascendancy of others with leadership potential. Dr. Mahathir's attempts to undercut the opposition party Islam using religion had serious and lasting consequences, and this relates specifically to the current controversy over the use of the word Allah. By choosing to fight Islam with more Islam, he pushed Malaysia in a conservative, illiberal direction that ultimately was at odds with the process of modernization he was seeking to promote. Fatefully, in 1988, he amended the constitution to raise Sharia courts to co-equal status with the civil law courts, a decision that still causes anguish in families physically split by religion, and accelerated a process that has been called creeping Islamization. UMNO is in long-term decline after losing support among Malays for more than a decade, notwithstanding a dramatic spike in the party's popularity in 2004, proved to be temporary. Non-Malays are increasingly reluctant to back the 12 other parties in the ruling coalition, known as the National Front, especially those representing ethnic Chinese and Indian minorities, because they are clearly subservient to UMNO. It is doubtful if the National Front will be viable much longer without a major overhaul. Like other countries, Malaysia is struggling to overcome the results of last year's global economic meltdown, but on top of that, the government must address the extremely sensitive issue of affirmative action, which has become a major encumbrance. It undermines Malaysia's competitiveness in a region where powerhouses China and India loom ever larger, while leaving the poorest Malaysians behind. Nevertheless, the drubbing the National Front government suffered in a general election in 2008 took most people by surprise. In Malaysia, it was called a political tsunami. Three opposition parties brought into an alliance by Anwar Ibrahim, the charismatic former deputy prime minister, won enough seats in parliament for the first time to deny the government its customary two-thirds majority, which has enabled it to change the constitution at whim. The opposition also took control of five of Malaysia's 13 state governments, including economic powerhouses Selangor and Penang. In any country that aspires to be democratic, the emergence of a credible opposition should be welcome. But UMNO has reacted harshly to the electoral threat. Instead of undertaking the reforms that would freshen its electoral appeal, the party has resorted to strong-arm tactics and time-honoured appeals to Malay fears. To quote Tunku Razali again, remembering he is a veteran of UMNO himself, quote, "It's about putting fear into the minds of the people," unquote. UMNO has harped on the possible loss of what is known as Ketuanan Melayu, which means Malay domination, including the manipulation of Islam, which is an important element in Malay identity. The Allah issue is a classic example. As Malaysian political commentator Karim Razlan wrote recently, quote, "The country's political landscape is in the process of being redrawn as UMNO, once the arbiter of middle-of-the-road Malay decency, lurches towards an atavistic and extremist future," unquote. This month's violence, exposing deepening ethno-religious divisions in Malaysian society, mocks the efforts of Prime Minister Najib, who has made his rallying cry in his first year in office, One Malaysia. He will need to show considerably more political resolve and leadership if he is to realise his ambition of heading an inclusive and united country. Despite Najib's relative youth, he was only 55 when he became Prime Minister last April, he is an UMNO insider and not a natural reformer. The son of Malaysia's second Premier, Tun Razak Hussein, Najib has been in politics all his adult life. He took his father's seat in Parliament at 22 when his father died in office quite suddenly. He's been a member of Malaysia's cabinet since he was 32. As one of his closest associates told me, Najib is not only part of the system, he is the system. In his first 9 months in office, Najib has talked reform about reducing corruption, improving economic efficiency, and making government more accountable. With the exception of some limited economic measures, however, it has amounted to tinkering. Malaysians have heard it all before from Najib's predecessor, Abdullah Badawi, who won a huge mandate in 2004 by promising reform and was hit by the political tsunami in 2008 when he failed to deliver. The problem might be resolved if the opposition won power, taking over the government for a term or two while UMNO and the National Front rejuvenated themselves in the political wilderness. But the Malaysian opposition, which raised popular expectations with its psychological victory almost 2 years ago, has disappointed many people. While the opposition, of course, consists of these three unlikely allies: the overwhelmingly Malay Party Islam, the predominantly Chinese Democratic Action Party, and Anwar's multiracial People's Justice Party. They've managed to hammer out a common platform, but they found it difficult to cooperate. The opposition coalition is called the People's Front. It's tarnished its own reputation by also engaging in dispiriting politicking instead of trying to prove itself worthy of a shot at office. Anwar undermined his own credibility by setting a deadline for enough government MPs to cross the floor of parliament to enable the People's Front to take over without waiting for the next election, in the event none crossed. Instead, the National Front enticed enough defectors from Anwar's ranks to switch sides to recapture Perak, resulting in violence in the state legislature as some members of the elected government resisted eviction. Incidentally, while the National Front government regained Perak, it did itself no favors with the people of that state. They clearly had voted for the People's Front, and as indicated by opinion polls, just as clearly wanted a fresh election to resolve the matter. Instead, it is being argued in the courts. The performance of the People's Front in administering the states it won in 2008 also has been less than stellar. Part of it is due to their inexperience and incompetence, and part a result of the state's limited powers and resources. For example, the 13 states between them get a mere 9% of the federal budget. Given these realities, the People's Front administrations would have been well advised to knuckle down and show their determination and commitment rather than grandstanding and inevitably coming up short. To compound the opposition's woes, Anwar is about to go on trial for sodomy again, having spent years in jail a decade ago before eventually being cleared of sodomy by Malaysia's courts. He's been charged this time on the complaint of a university dropout. While opinion polls have shown that Malaysians don't believe the police case, it cannot be assumed he will walk free. Were he to be convicted, he would almost certainly be jailed again for years, depriving the People's Front of its one inspirational leader who alone seems capable of holding the three parties together. Ultimately, that is why I'm gloomy about Malaysia's immediate prospects. The outlook is for more political uncertainty. The long term, I remain optimistic because I believe in the innate good sense of the Malaysian people. UMNO under Najib shows no inclination to make the fundamental reforms that are absolutely essential for the country's progress, but it still may manage to hang on. The ideal would be the consolidation of a two-party system, but just now, stalemate or upheaval seems more likely. Thank you.
Barry, would you like to sit down for the Q&A session?
Yep.
Okay. So we'll be going to questions now. Can I ask you please to raise your hand and identify yourself and your organization. Keep your questions short. Thank you very much. And I see lots of hands. Start with Tom here on the top table.
Hello, I'm Tom Easton. I'm with The Economist. I just want to start, I rarely ask questions from the front, but I just want to say that was the most scintillating discussion that I have heard in 3 years at the Foreign Correspondents Club. So cool. I wanted to thank you very much for making it. Drilling down just a little bit, Khazanah, you know, sovereign wealth funds are always interesting reflections of the governments and the states in which they exist. It has said that it has gone through substantial reform. It has changed substantially its affirmative action policies. It has created some sort of meritocracy. And this somehow reflects actually broader change in, Malaysia itself. And I was just wondering if you thought there was any credibility whatsoever to those statements. And what role you thought Khazanah was playing. You know, it used to be the warehouse where all the bastard state companies went.
Yes. Hi.
Much as I'd like to say I know everything about Malaysia, I have to confess that I'm not tracking Khazanah closely recently. In general, I remain very sceptical about that situation. I don't see any signs of real reform in the economy. Most of it has been around the edges, and I'd be surprised if Khazanah is really playing that sort of role they claim for it now.
Zach Coleman.
Hi there, Zach Coleman from the Financial Times. How much influence would you say Dr. Mahathir has now in the current political situation?
As many of you may know, Dr. Mahathir is a regular blogger. He has his own site, and it's extremely popular, and he weighs in on everything, and and including, I might add, three separate blogs on my book. I was delighted when he titled his second blog Malaysian Maverick, which of course is the title of the book. I thought, that's my man. But in the third blog, he trashed my book, so I thought, no, I don't like him after all. he retains a solid following in the country, but I don't believe he influences Najib's decisions very much at all. He's criticized Najib a number of times, but he hasn't attacked him in anything like the personal and vindictive way he did with Najib's predecessor. So I think the government remains a little bit wary of him and his following and what any sort of opposition he may be able to arouse on a particular issue, but he's not calling the shots any longer.
Steve, you had a question?
Yeah, Steve Owens. Barry, I'm just wondering about Mahathir. Do you think he is fundamentally, in terms of belief, a Malay nationalist, or is this essentially all about political expedience?
I have no doubt whatsoever. He's a Malay nationalist and a Malaysian, and then he morphed into a Malaysian nationalist as he matured. You see the signs of it right from when he was younger, when he first went into Parliament. When he first started writing in the 60s, it was all about the plight of the Malays and what needed to be done, and then the need for some sort of affirmative action to raise them economically and give them the same sort of status in Malaysia as Chinese and perhaps Indians.
We have the gentleman there in the veranda, the back.
My name is Kian. I'm wondering, what advice would you have for the public of Malaysia in general, what they can do to help reforms, and what sort of advice would you have for the people of Malaysia?
I'm sitting here wondering if the Malaysian government's going to ban my book, so I think I should be asking Malaysians what I can do to save my book. I wouldn't really buy indirectly offering advice. I just think I note there is a real still, despite the disillusionment with the opposition I mentioned, I think there's still a real strong movement across all ethnic communities in Malaysia for reform, just to get some basic honesty and decency back in the government. And one has seen this with a number of high-profile defections from government parties and other people who are not, in the past, haven't been involved in politics, who've just come forward and sort of say, look, I've got to do this for my country, and they're doing it. And those people who are benefiting from the entrenched system at the moment, they'll fight it all the way. But I believe eventually that probably those forces of reform will need to prevail if the country's going to have a decent future.
Go to the heart of the condition of Malaysia. A lot of people's original charges were fabricated. Somebody who's involved in a lot of litigation, they certainly look that way to me, as a complete outsider. For him to be rearrested on the same charge, he either can't keep his hands off them, or there is something seriously wrong with the government. Because if it is true that the government trumped up these charges,
and imprisoned a man of his seniority and standing for that period. There's something really, 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 really seriously wrong with the whole fabric of the government.
I can assure you it's the latter. I think there's no doubt whatsoever. When I came to, I've written a couple of chapters before Dr. Mahathir became Prime Minister and a chapter after he retired from Prime Ministership, but I've treated his Prime Ministership in themes, economics, politics, foreign policy, and I've given an entire chapter to the Anwar episode, and it is just, it is just not even closely contested. The charges against him were rigged, the cases were fabricated, the special branch beat up witnesses to do it, and when you review it, with the benefit of expert legal advice on the way the trials were conducted and everything else, it was a fix. That's without making any comments about Anwar at all. That was what was rigged, and that comes across fairly clearly. One is just simply to deal with the evidence. It surprised me how overwhelming it was. It's there on the record if you just work your way through it. And this goes to the heart of it. See, in most countries where I've just been criticizing the ruling party. But the problem is when you have a ruling party or a party in for a long time, the corruption spreads just beyond the politics. You get a politicized civil service. The problem, you know, with corruption is in the judiciary, it's in the attorney, it's in the police department, it's in the attorney general's chambers. And so we had a case under Abdullah Badawi where there was a royal commission into... Well, a lawyer appeared on a video clip. He appeared to be boasting that he could fix judicial appointments. And the revelations of that were quite striking. And the recommendations were to be turned over to the Attorney General Office for legal action against a number of people, including Dr. Mahathir. And then the government just said, well, there's no, we don't think we can sustain a case against these people, and just let it go away. The corruption spreads way beyond just the politicians.
Down here in the front, John Berthelsen.
How much do you think the Allah controversy changes the current political equation?
It's very hard to say, John. I think that I think in some ways it's a one when you review what has happened over the last 10 or 15 years with the disputes between the Umno-led government and the opposition over Islam. One can easily see how this has come about, how Islam has been politicized and made use of. This has really frightened a lot of people, and hopefully it'll be a wake-up call, and people will retreat from people in authority will retreat from extremist statements in future. But I think we'll just have to wait and see how it plays out. It really isn't clear.
I see a lot of hands, but Philip Bowring at the back, please.
Commend it to everybody here. It's fair, accurate, and well written. However, I do have a question about whether writing this book, you obviously had access to most of the players involved, including Mahathir, several interviews with him. Would it be possible for you, or indeed anybody else, to write a similar book about Lee Kuan Yew, the Lee family, and the People's Action Party? And if not, why not?
It's funny when Dr. Mahathir decided to get into me. He made similar comments. He said, "If Barry Wayne had written this book in Singapore, he'd be in jail by now." As a lot of his colleagues, like John Berthelsen, unsaid would say. Yes, I suspect it's not possible to. Personally, I've never had the interest in Singapore politics at all. As a reporter, I didn't ever want to be based in Singapore to write about Singapore because I felt that, you know, it was pretty barren, sort of not interesting. Whereas Malaysia is just the opposite. But I suspect that it's very difficult to write a similar book about the Singapore leaders. Yeah.
This gentleman here.
Yeah. My name's Yap. I'm a Malaysian. I just want to ask about Sabah and Sarawak, because they hold a lot of the parliamentary seats and they can make a difference. Okay? I work in Sarawak for 2 years, a couple of years back. I don't really know their political thinking. Well, I can say they are pretty provincial in some ways. Okay? So can you add some knowledge in that way?
All I can say is that I think historically Sabah and Sarawak have just been basically ignored, and I think they've paid a price economically. They haven't developed as they should have. They've provided a lot of the resources for the country, for the benefit of the nation, and they've been ignored. I think they now have. Sabah and Sarawak now have the best opportunity they've ever had, I think, since the formation of Malaysia in 63, to exert some pressure and get some of the resources channeled back to them and to develop, because they have the large numbers of seats. There's now a credible opposition, and were they, for instance, to throw their support, their seats behind the opposition, they could bring the opposition to power. So one way or another, they should be able to leverage their position to improve the lot of their own people and overcome those years of neglect.
Alice, in the front.
So I can't quite, Malaysia should support what?
Should support the court ruling. I was wondering what your thoughts are on the development of the past and the last few years. Ideologically, has it changed, or is this plain politics, or is this People's Justice Party just anyone telling them to put out a united front on the issue?
Yeah, the question's about Party Islam, PAS. I think we've seen that PAS does have factions in it, and there's certainly ulama, religious faction that's not inclined to sort of compromise and not inclined to sort of, enter into coalition politics. So far, Anwar's been able to persuade the party to come into coalition and to offer the prospect, to put aside its sort of ideological or religious purity, the shining goal of an Islamic state near term, and put that aside for the which gives them absolutely no chance of ever gaining power. They need a majority of support in Malaysia to get that, and majority will never support an Islamic state. So Anwar's been able to bring his influence to bear and considerable organizational talent so that he can convince PAS to come along with him, and the prospect of actually getting to power and able to achieving some of its ends, if not the ultimate goal that it wants to. So it's still not 100% clear to me that they will stay. I think for the time being they're committed to the coalition, and we'll just have to wait to see how the factionism plays out.
In the veranda, please. And then,
sorry. I'm George Long. If you were a political risk analyst, what percentage odds would you put on Malaysia descending into serious communal violence? I mean, you've already seen small elements of that in the last couple of weeks with the burning of churches, but do you think that's a very serious risk that we could have something like in the 50s or 60s in Indonesia and Malaysia reappear?
Actually, I don't. As I made, just in passing, I made reference to my belief in the sort of good sense of the Malaysian people, and I really believe that. I believe basically most Malaysians are very sensible, even with their strongly held opposing views. So I think that's why I'm hopeful that this violence that has occurred is obviously quite shocking to most Malaysians that it should happen. And we've already seen, the Islamic groups go out to protect Christian churches and gestures like this. And I think this should, if anything, help bring the community together and isolate extremists on both sides.
The gentleman there with the striped shirt, followed by the other gentleman on the same table.
Hi, Barry. Thank you for the talk. My name is T.L. Lim. I was born in Malaysia. I grew up in Malaysia. And I subsequently emigrated to Australia, so I found your talk very interesting. Thank you for that. I have a question regarding the opposition. You mentioned that Anwar is very charismatic. There is the possibility of him going to jail again. I note that the old war horses of the opposition, Lim Kit Siang, Kapal Singh, and that, you know, they fought a good fight, but they are getting on in their age. Who do you see any up and coming other opposition leaders who might be charismatic, who might take on the good fight, so to speak?
Well, of course, Guaneng has taken over, the Sun has taken over from Lim Kit Singh and the DAP. I don't see a lot of new leaders coming on, but among those who are very promising, or considerably promising, they don't have Anwar's ability to reach out to those other parties. Somehow or other, even though there's still a lot of skepticism about Anwar in Malaysians because he seems to be always changing sides, somehow or other, he has that ability to somehow convince the DAP, you know, kind of a left of center, predominantly Chinese party, to cooperate with Party Islam, you know, that sort of ultimately in its heart sort of would like an Islamic state. And, you know, it hasn't been an easy coalition, but he's managed them to stay together. And I think there's a real concern that if he, they're trying to put an arrangement in place, so if Anwar goes to jail, that they can carry on. But I would have real, I think the odds lengthen against them by being successful if Anwar disappears from the scene. There isn't anyone else with that same ability.
Mark Pinkston. Barry, thank you for your insight into the Malaysian politics and your in-depth study. You mentioned earlier that the Malaysian government is still contemplating its neighbour whether to accept the book or not, that Mahathir has totally trashed it. But has there been any reaction from Anwar Ibrahim?
It's a strange state of affairs. Malaysia, one of its endearing qualities is it's usually fairly incompetent with doing things, and that provides an opportunity, you know, for all sorts of things to happen. And you know, back to Philip's question about Singapore, the non-governmental organisations will tell you in Malaysia they have a lot more room to move despite restrictions on their activities than they would say if they were in Singapore. The government just doesn't get round to being as well organised as it should be. The strange state of affairs with my book is that, you know, there are 800 copies and it went into Port Klang by ship from Hong Kong. But the book's not illegal in Malaysia. Their books are just in that there, waiting for the Home Minister to say. Meanwhile, Malaysians, of course, have been buying it in Singapore in large numbers. I mean, we've actually sold out we're actually on our third reprint in Singapore. The book's been reprinted 3 times in 5 weeks because, and that's stimulated strongly by demand from Malaysia into Singapore. And, you know, the book is being sent in, mailed in, airmailed in, and carried in, and there's got to be hundreds of copies there, but still we're waiting to see where it's going to be allowed to sell. But as I say, it's not illegal. So in this strange state of affairs, people are kind of reluctant to say Dr. Mahathir said in one of these things he'd read a draft. Well, there's no such thing as a draft of my book. You either have the book or you don't have it, you know. This is quite a strange thing. But I don't think Anwar hasn't. And of course, let's face it, it's become a political football. So the DAP have called for a royal commission into some of the allegations in that. In the book, Dr. Mahathir said, "I support a royal commission." Dr. Mahathir incidentally supported my book going on sale. He also reserved the right to sue me, but anyway, that's a different matter. He said, "I'll support a royal commission into my sort of alleged wrongdoings, as long as we include the wrongdoings allegedly done by Abdullah Badawi." And then the Prime Minister said, "We're not going to have another royal commission because everyone knows royal commissions in Malaysia don't mean anything, and we're having too many of them already." So. There's a little bit of a game that goes on. Anwar hasn't commented on it publicly. Someone reported back the other day that he did use the book and spoke about it in a speech addressed to a political rally.
Just one last question here. Thank you.
The politicization of Islam is one of the recurring themes. For the past really
It really is a problem. But the voting trends in the 2008 general election, that there were some very optimistic signs in in the patterns of that voting. Excuse me. And one of the things is that you get a lot of people, or get considerable numbers of people, who are simply fed up with the politicization of religion, fed up with extremism and that, and fed up with appeals to, you know, communal appeals, and believe that, you know, to build a nation you've got to bring everyone together. So in 2008, the people who supported the opposition, one of the positive trends was that people voted across ethnic lines for the first time. So, it's almost unbelievable now. Sometimes at a by-election, you see Party Islam and DAP people side by side supporting the same candidate. I mean, it's just extraordinary. In Malaysian terms, it's extraordinary, but extremely welcome as well, because normally they would just simply be in the past be bad-mouthing each other and never be seen together. So I think there is a trend that, again, this is the reformist trend I spoke about earlier. How strong it is, we'll have to wait and see, where people just simply say, enough is enough, this is all going on in the wrong direction, we've got to stop organizing and the political system and everything else, every other basis of Malaysia, we've got to stop organizing it along ethnic lines and organizing it along national lines for the benefit of the nation.
I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up there, but thank you all for coming today, and I'd like to thank you very much, Barry, for a wonderful talk, and as a token of our gratitude, I'd like to present you with this small club. Thank you all very much. So you're going to be signing books over there, yeah?
Okay, Tom.
You were saying the other day, we're a hub, Hong Kong's a hub where all the smoke's go north.